back now, would you take me back in? I wanna live in your house, I wanna be close to you, and I'll never do anything you wouldn't want me to do. I wanna live, I wanna live again.
You're listening to WRCT, and this is Anatomy of the Ear. On Sunday, the final day of Anatomy of the Ear, and I'm August Personage. We're doing the Bakersfield sound. Getting close to halfway through the hour, and we heard songs from the likes of Joe and Rosalie Mathis, Wanda Jackson, Bonnie Bluebell, the Farmer Boys. That was a bit more towards the rockabilly side of things for a couple of songs there. And then after that, we heard two from Gene Shepherd, Harold Cox and the Sooners, and one from Glenda Blackwell, I Want to Live in Your House. Incidentally, I'm forever grateful for Bear Family Records and their compilation, The Bakersfield Sound, Country Music Capital of the West, 1940 to 1974, for being such an excellent resource for jumping into the breadth of this music. Now here's Buck Owens.
I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. Well, I thought the day I met you, you were meek as a lamb, just the kind to fit my dreams and plans. Now the pace we're living takes the wind from my sails, and it looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. Well, every night you drag me where the bright lights are found. A leaf in a gale, and it looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail.
Me. And you say you ain't never coming back, that you're sick and tired of how I'm doing, and you're gonna head off down the track. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you, and that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had. If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go. Oh, your wounded pride is blinded.
your reason. And right now you want to hurt me if you can. The man is waiting here to take you to the station. And you're leaving with your ticket in your hand. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you. And that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had. If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go. Heart and let my love come in. I know you've been hurt by an old love affair, but darling, don't blame me, I wasn't even there. Your long, lonely nights I will bring to an end when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my life begin. The sun's gonna shine, there'll be blue skies again when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Has made your heart hurt. Your long, lonely nights I will bring to an end when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my life begin. The sun's gonna shine, there'll be blue skies again when you open up your heart and let my love come in. When you open up your heart and let my love come in.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up, and she's a-running like never before. There's a speed zone ahead, well, all right. I can dodge all the cops in sight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. I got 10 Ford gears and a Georgia overdrive. I'm taking little white pills, and my eyes are open wide. I just passed a Jimmy and a White. I've been a-passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. Well, it seems like a month since I kissed my baby goodbye. I could have a lot of women, but I'm not that kind of a guy. I could find one to hold me tight, but I could never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. ICC is a checking on down the line. I'm a little overweight and my logbook's way behind. But nothing bothers me tonight. I can dodge all the scales all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. flying from her stack, and that smoke's a blowing black as coal. Well, my hometowns are coming in sight. If you think I'm happy, you're right. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road, and I'm
tonight. I keep real busy all day and part of the night. I just scrub and I polish everything there is inside. Then I keep a walking to the door, waiting for that truck to roar. 6 days of waiting, and he better make it home tonight.
Got an aching head and bloodshot eyes. I met up with a pretty little dame. I didn't even know her name. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. If I deliver this hotshot crate, I gotta get her going cause I'm running late. These mountain grades are mighty steep. Can't stay awake, I ain't had no sleep. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. The cute little waitress at the bottom of the grade, she's got the coffee already made. I gotta keep my eyes up on the road cause I'm going down the hill with a heavy load. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. Well, I must have closed my eyes for a while cause here I am and I'm a running wild. I burnt my brakes, stripped my gears, gonna have to ride her down, I fear. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. I wish I'd left the women alone, but it's too late now cause I think I'm gone. I got myself into this fix just because I tried to mix. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. Diesel smoke,
danger's curve.
Here's Biff Adam on the drums and Dennis Romack on the bass, Bobby Wayne on rhythm guitar, Mr. Norman Hamlet on the steel, and Roy Nichols on the lead electric guitar. And I'm Merle Haggard, and I'm introducing the Strangers with a song they wrote for self entitled Stealing Corn. One and two and three and four. Thank you, boys.
Some wealthy ones like you laugh down on the common folk like me and making bets to what degree of fool we are. From your rose-colored windows, you see yourself above us, standing in the mud and gazing at the stars. But the rich and poor have in common the common cold, the heartburn, and the heartache, and put our pants on just the same. Now your wealth don't make you better, babe, 'cause I can't. got your raisin girl in your diamond-studded world. I got pulled up on the hungry side of town. Cut my teeth on bacon rind, and there ain't no hide as thick as mine, but it might be fun a while to be your clown. So get your whip and do your thing, and I'll run around the ring riding a white horse wearing an armor too.
Ah, but I don't easy bliss to be. I'll be your court just to be. But don't think you won't pay the fiddler too. Back when you put your hand in mine, it was a shocking thing to find the water hot, the current strong and deep and wet. You had me struggling for time, dangling on your line. Ah, but never fear, this fish never sweat. While you're playing with my mind, I'll be playing with your money, honey, as long as your account can stand the drain. I'll fan the flame and make it hotter, cause I think I can walk on water, long as you can make it rain. I think if I hang around a while, study your style, I'll come out a whole lot wiser, man, at least. Cause the last time anyone as grand as you appeared, they looked around, found a brand new star up in the east. Hey, but I don't see no halo, just a little girl with a lot of gold, wanting one more drinky for your golden chain. Well, you got a hot one hanging, kid, don't let them say you never did your best. Be my guest, make it rain.
Another. Well, she got right up and she walked right out the door. Well, you know she didn't love you, this one thing you knew. But you need a vaccination, a shot for the blues. I sit and wonder and I cry, cry, cry. I get so lonely I could die.
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
You know, just reading all the articles, you get the sense that it was, and I tried to explain it when I'm writing it, it's one of the most important moments in sports, especially for Black Americans. My guess is if you talk to a Black American who was alive at that time watching football, they would tell you they were rooting for Washington for one reason, right? Even, I know you guys are in Texas, even Cowboys fans had to admit, yeah, so that you had to admit that you were rooting for
Doug. Yes, I was.
In that instance, right, because of what it meant, right? The idea of how important the quarterback is, the lack of really seeing Black people in those type of spaces, it comes at the perfect time to Jesse Jackson's about to make a run for the Democratic nominee. Now, he doesn't win, but, you know, you have that there, and it's just, you know, Black folks after Black folks in real time talking about how important, how symbolic that moment is to them.
Dr. Lewis Moore, professor of history at Grand Valley State University, historian, co-host of the Black Athlete Podcast, and author of The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and the Making of the Black Quarterback, published by Hatchet Book Group. In 1979, it was still a foreign concept that African-American men could be the field generals. Two African-American players changed that notion. The Chicago Bears' Vince Evans, the fastest quarterback in the league, and Doug Williams, a man with the best arm in the game, who won a Super Bowl and played for several teams before becoming a coach. They were the only two starters. Before them, coaches rerouted African-American players with quarterback skills to play as running backs or wide receivers. With that assumption, regardless of speed and strength, African-Americans lacked the intelligence to lead a team. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Great Black Hope with Dr. Lewis Moore, In Black America.
The best way to describe Vince is he's a running back, right? Mm-hmm. Even in high school, he's a single-wing quarterback, but if folks out there know about the single wing, it's a running formation. And he ran 90% of the time in high school. And then eventually goes to USC. And USC is known for their running back U, right? That's where OJ went, Anthony Davis went, Ricky Bell. And he's handing off a lot of the times, and he's rolling out. But then his senior year, they get a new coach. They get John Robinson, who eventually will coach in the pros with the Rams, because John McKay goes coach Tampa Bay. And Robinson starts to add a little bit more wrinkles to the offense to allow Vince Evans to throw, right? He's still going to take advantage of his 4.5 sport 40 speed, but he also has a quarterback coach, Paul Hackett, who's probably one of the best quarterback coaches ever. And he takes time for the first time ever to develop Vince Evans. Very few white coaches ever took the time to develop a Black quarterback.
There is no position in professional sports more recognizable, lucrative, and important than an NFL quarterback. Since 1946, the league had always been integrated, but playing quarterback was the exclusive position of white players for many decades. When Doug Williams and Vince Evans arrived in the league in the late 1970s, African-American players were often dismissed as lacking the intellect of a quarterback. Both received death threats, faced racist questions, and knew that a single mistake could end their careers. When Wilson and Evans faced each other at Soldier Field on September 30, 1979, it was rightly seen as a historic moment. The time had finally come, two men of color leading their team on the gridiron. In his book, The Great Black Hope, Moore looks back in time at the lineage of African-American players who, by right, should have preceded them. recently in Black America, spoke with Dr. Lewis Moore.
I am from California, so I spent my first 30 years out there and finished my PhD at UC Davis. Then we made our way out here in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 2008 so I could take the Grand Valley State job. So I've been here ever since.
And prior to Grand Valley State, where were you teaching?
I was just finishing up my PhD at UC Davis. So undergrad at Sacramento State, PhD at UC Davis, and then came straight from California to the cold Michigan.
I heard that. So what sparked that interest in history?
So I was college. And so I always liked, you know, history. I didn't know I could do it. And I always loved sports history, like Negro League stuff. And I was sitting in a college classroom my senior year, and we had to do a senior paper on California history. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do any of this. And then finally the professor's like, you can do sports. And so I wind up doing the Jack Johnson-Jim Jeffries fight. Now, that fight doesn't take place in California, but it started there, and then it moved to Reno, Nevada. So as a senior in college, I was just looking at the California aspect, used that paper to get into a master's program, worked on that, and used that to get into a PhD program, and actually turned that paper into, you know, into a dissertation and into a book. So that was it. I just had professors who allowed me to be me, and then, you know, that love of sports comes through.
We Win the Day. Was that the dissertation, the Civil Rights Movement?
So they came out at the same time. So We Will Win the Day, that came out at the same time as the dissertation, which is now called I Fight for a Living.
Mm-hmm.
So 2017, I Fight for a Living, which is Boxing and the Battle for Black Manhood, 1880 to 1915 came out. And then a version of We Will Win the Day, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Athlete, and the Quest for Equality came out. So I wrote that right after the boxing book. But the way the publishers work, there are two different publishers. One took longer than the other, and so they wound up coming out the same week.
What makes those particular books important for a person to read?
Oh, so one thing you'll get from me is I'm trying to tell the story of America and Black America through the Black athlete. And so this is like, let's say if you studied that time period, let's say for I Fight for a Living, which is late 1800s and early 1900s, you've probably heard of people like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells. These are the people you've never heard of, right? Unless it's like you're a big time boxing fan. But a lot of it's like these are the working class Black folks that we don't get to talk about because they leave nothing behind. So it's like, what did a man who was 20 who had no choices but to fight do, and why did he fight? Where did he go? How much money he made? So you're learning about just, you know, working class Black manhood at the turn of the century. Now, with We Will Win the Day, it's really a look at the civil rights movement through the Black athlete, either as they participated or how a lot of Americans watched someone like a Jackie Robinson or a Larry Doby and started to put their hopes for democracy on these athletes. So it's just the best way to think about my work is you take these Black athletes and they're a window into who we were as a nation.
How is sports so intertwined in American society?
Oh, it's perfect to study, and it's intertwined because in America, we like to tell ourselves that merit matters, right? The best get everything if you work the hardest. But in sports, it's really the only place it happens. And so people love that about sports because it gives us a sense of fairness, which doesn't really exist in society, right? There are a lot of people who are born on third base and will tell you they've hit a triple. But in sports, you got to hit that triple. Or if we watch the Olympics, you're either the fastest person in the world or you're not, right? Everybody starts from the same starting block, right? You have the same training. You have pretty much the same shoes. So there's no advantages. And I think we like that about sports. And it also allows us to feel good about ourselves in a society that, to be clear, hasn't been fair, right? Like when we talk about Jim Crow and everything like that, here it allows us to lie and say, well, you know what? Jackie got a chance. Joe Louis got a chance. Even though they're facing Jim Crow, you could still celebrate that.
What led you to write this current book, The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and the Making of the Black Quarterback?
Oh, I love Black quarterbacks. And I wanted to write a book about Black quarterbacks. And it was like 2020 and it's the pandemic and I had nothing to do. Except, you know, shoot hoops with my kids all day because we couldn't go anywhere. And I started to kick around ideas about how I could tell this story. Do I want to tell everybody's story or do I want to kind of write this narrative about a few guys and try to tell the story of the Black quarterback? And so I realized that telling it through Doug Williams, who to me is the most important, probably the most important football player ever. Certainly one of the most popular quarterbacks. And then someone like Vince Evans, who, you know, if you're a hardcore fan, you've heard of him. But if you haven't, that's great, because I want to tell you his story, because he's important, right? Like, if you follow football today, he's Lamar Jackson before Lamar Jackson, or, you know, you guys are from Texas. He's Jalen Hurts, right, before Jalen Hurts. And it's like, how do you get to Jalen Hurts? Well, you get to him via Vince Evans and everything he had to go through.
Now, you interwove history into this narrative. Talk to us about Doug Williams and his upbringing. We're going to talk about Vince and his upbringing also. But his upbringing in Louisiana.
Yeah, so Doug is rural Louisiana, like small town. And what I say...
Cheneyville,
right? And it's hard for folks to wrap their head around it. It's not a city, right? It's like it's just a community of black folks that lived there after slavery into, you know, Reconstruction, and this is how they formed a community on the land that they were working in sharecropping, but with the hopes and desire of owning it, right? And so these people before Doug, generations before Doug, you know, they would do everything they could to own the land, to have some kind of independence and true freedom. At the same time, you know, Baton Rouge is the major city next to them, which just ignore them, right? So a lot of times there's no running water, there's no paved roads, no electricity, you're kind of on your own. And that's how Doug grew up, even after World War II. So he grows up in this very tight-knit black community where everybody knows each other. And, you know, he develops his arm, you know, through that type of poverty, through that type of neglect, right? Throwing rocks or playing with, you know, big fruit seeds or whatever, trying to hit a baseball bat and just playing sports. But it's also a community that loves sports, right? They love baseball. They built their own football field, if you can believe that, at the high school level. And that's how he grew up. And I think it toughened him up. It made him understand the world he was going to see, even though he wasn't ready for it. And I think it's why he's able to, you know, conquer the biggest moment in sports, right? That tight-knit black community that he grew up, that made him.
Now, Doug was a baseball player before he had to make a decision when he went to Grambling, right?
Right. Yeah, so Doug was a top-notch pitching prospect. One scout called him one of the best pitching prospects in the nation. His brother wound up playing, got high-level AAA. With the Cleveland organization, and Doug played his freshman year at Grambling, and Eddie Robinson was like, yeah, you got to make a choice, right? And when Eddie Robinson, I don't care when it is, whether it's 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, tells you to make a choice to choose football, then you're going to choose football. And it was a pretty smart choice, right? You know, Doug got his career in the NFL and baseball for just to make it. You know, I know, you know, it's not about baseball, but for a young black guy to make it on the pitching mound at that time, it's not easy, right? You'd have to go through single A, double A, triple A, all these levels. And even though there are black superstar pitchers, right, like Vida Blue, who's from Louisiana, the chance of you making it, them, you know what I mean, it's a lot harder. Even, I don't know if it's harder to make it as a quarterback, but the chance of you making it is really hard.
Now, Doug was playing baseball, and during that period, he experienced his first incident with prejudice.
Yeah, and so what's interesting about Doug is that because he's in this kind of tight-knit black community, he doesn't have, like, a lot of... Now, he goes through Jim Crow, obviously, right. He grows up, but he's not seeing whites face-to-face. It's baseball when he's really playing in these kind of integrated spaces, and that's when he's getting called the N-word and dealing with it from teammates and opposing players and just having to deal with that in the sporting world, right? He, you know, before that, he's all black football teams, and so, as I said in the book, like, this idea that he's a black quarterback doesn't exist in his mind because he's only a black quarterback. It's only like when he gets into these white sporting spaces is then he has to deal with that type of racism.
Now, Vince, urban versus rural, talk to us about him in Greensboro.
Yeah, so Vince Evans grows up in Greensboro, and for those folks who know about the civil rights, it's one of the hubs of the civil rights movement. The urban city, his parents are middle class, they're teachers. He actually grows up in this middle class black community that's actually built in the 1950s for middle class black folks, right? So they don't go and try to buy homes in white neighborhoods. So it's like, let's build you guys something nice here. And unlike Doug, Vince, when they're the same age, right? So they senior year 1972. But because of the history of the civil rights movement there, schools are becoming integrated. And the best way to explain Vince's experience is for folks who've seen the movie Remember the Titans. So in that movie, the black students go to the white school, and that's what happens with Vince, right? Now, Greensboro has a black school, and some white students go there, but we never really tell those stories. But Vince is the black kid on the bus, and he's playing quarterback. And his junior year is the first year of forced integration with busing and everything like that, just like you see with Remember the Titans. And that's how he grows up, right? And even before that, he had gone to, like, integrated junior high and another integrated high school. So his relationship with white folks is a little bit different than Doug growing up. And I think that that also prepares Vince in a different way.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio and speaking with Lewis Moore, historian of African-American history and sports history, professor of history at Grand Valley State University, co-host of the Black Athlete Podcast, and author of The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and the Making of the Black Quarterback. Throughout the book, Mr. Moore, you talk about civil rights, but you also talk about how the game of football in the NFL had changed. Talk to us about the T formation and how that kind of revolutionized pro football.
Yeah, so the T formation is what we would call in football, like if we were like the 1940s, we call it the original formation. And so I'll be brief here. But, 1890s, early 1900s, most teams ran that T formation. So if listeners can imagine, you have your offensive line, you have your quarterback under center, like kind of like today, unless they're in the shotgun. And then they snap it, he hands it to him, and he generally has three running backs behind him. And so that looks like a T, and it gives them the ball. Then a couple years later, like 1906, they add the pass, and that's when the single wing came about. And so from about 1906 to 1940, the majorities of teams were running a variation of the single wing. It allowed them to pass, spread out the field, but it wasn't really precision passing, right? It's like big chunk plays, and then the quarterback would run. So the best way I explain people the single wing is like the wildcat formation, where that snap goes back to the best athlete, and he's generally running forward. And then in 1940, the T formation makes this comeback. And it makes a comeback because Clark Shaughnessy and then George Hollis, who are in Chicago, tinker with the T formation. And one of the biggest changes they make is that they'll put a man in motion, right? So you still have the quarterback behind center and three running backs behind them, but they add a man in motion flanker position that allows the quarterback to read the defense a little bit better. And then what happens is from that moment, it takes off. Stanford, where Clark Shaughnessy's coaching, wins the Rose Bowl. The Bears win the world championship. And so football's copycat. 5 years later, 90% of people are running a variation of this, and that's when you start to see the changes. So in pro football, you'll get like what you call a pro set. So the quarterback will be behind the center, but now he'll have two running backs behind him, and that third running back becomes a flanker. You'll get the wing tee, which I believe Grambling was running. You'll get all kinds of stuff, whatever, Texas running. I don't know what the Texas Longhorns are running, but they were running stuff. They were dominating. But the key when it comes to the pros and it comes to the T formation, the quarterback becomes very important because now there's throwing with precision. He has to know all the plays, like 400 plays. He has to know what the defense is doing. He has to know what everyone else is doing. And that's when we start to develop this idea that he's the most important person of all sports. He has to be the smartest. He has to be the leader. And in 1940s America, they're saying black people can't do this. They're not smart enough, right? They can't lead white folks. And so that's when you start to see black folks being pushed out of that position in white spaces. Now, black teams, if they're running the T, to have a black quarterback. Like Prairie View would have had Charlie Cheech with Brackens, right? Who was one of the best quarterbacks in the 1950s. But when it comes to the pros, they're saying, you don't belong. You don't fit this mold.
How did Doug eventually have an opportunity to play in the NFL at quarterback?
So the best answer is Eddie Robinson. So listeners don't know Eddie Robinson. It's fair to say he's the greatest, if not one of the greatest coaches, college coaches of all time. And Eddie Robinson in the late 1950s switches to an offense called the wing T from the single wing. And then it's more of a running, allows the quarterback to run, to roll out and stuff. But mid-1960s, Eddie Robinson said, you know what? I want to get a pro quarterback in football, and I'll do anything I can. So he transforms his offense. He starts to throw more passes with his quarterbacks, and then he starts to get a specific type of quarterback, one that the NFL couldn't deny, right? No matter his, you know, no matter how black he was, he couldn't deny it. So the first one he got from James Shaq Harris, who was 6'4", had a cannon of arm, and he just developed him. Then he developed another one named Matthew Reed, and then he developed Doug Williams. And all this time, he's creating an offense that's similar to the pros. And the way he's doing it, he's bringing his old pros in. So Grambling, if listeners don't know, by the 60s, it is essentially like Notre Dame or USC, or the best way to reverse it is those schools are like Grambling. They're putting out the most pro players, them and Tennessee, right, Tennessee State. And so Doug has pro players coming back from the Browns, coming back from the Packers, teaching the offense, teaching what quarterbacks are supposed to do. And then Eddie Robinson makes also another key decision. He tells all of his quarterbacks, you are not running, right? You're going to stand in this pocket. Because the moment a black quarterback ran in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, NFL scouts is like, yep, we're going to switch positions. No matter how big he was, no matter how slow he was. And so there were guys who would, you know, when it's time to run the 40, would run slow on purpose. One of his guys, Matthew Reed, was a 4.3 40 guy at 6'4". Before he ran his 40 for pro scouts, he contemplated, like, should I do this? I know what they're going to do. He runs his best, and they switch him to tight end immediately. He never gets a shot. So Eddie Robinson was smart, and he plotted this moment. How do I get this guy in there? He got James Harris there, and eventually he got Doug Williams there.
So how did Vince make the transition to the NFL?
Oh, man, hard work. So Vince, the best way to describe Vince is he's a running back, right? Mm-hmm. Even in high school, he's a single-wing quarterback. But if folks out there know about the single wing, it's a running formation. And he ran 90% of the time in high school. And then he eventually goes to USC. And USC is known for the, you know, their running back U, right? That's where OJ went, Anthony Davis went, Ricky Bell. And he's handing off a lot of the times, and he's rolling out. But then his senior year, they get a new coach. They get John Robinson, who eventually will coach in the pros with the Rams, because John McKay goes to coach Tampa Bay. And Robinson starts to add a little bit more wrinkles to the offense to allow Vince Evans to throw, right? He's still going to take advantage of his 4.5 40 speed. But he also has a quarterback coach, Paul Hackett, who's probably one of the best quarterback coaches ever. And he takes time, for the first time ever, to develop Vince Evans. Very few white coaches ever took the time to develop a black quarterback. And he spent a year helping Vince out. Vince eventually gets drafted after he wins the Rose Bowl in the sixth round. And he puts in his contract, you cannot switch my position without my permission. And that was so huge, because black quarterbacks before him got the choice. You're going to switch, or you're going to be cut, or you got to go to Canada. And Vince was very clear. So it gave him a year, right, to get his feet wet, to try to learn the offense, to show what he could do in practice. Now, it wasn't enough. It takes him another year to get on the field. That's it. It's just hard work and dedication to say, you know what, I'm going to be a professional quarterback.
Now, both spent time in the USFL. Talk about their experiences there. And plus, they made a little money when they went to the league.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the things is the USFL comes about when, you know, both men are really struggling to earn respect from their respective teams. For Vince, it's, you know, Mike Ditka comes in 1982 and really doesn't like Vince Evans. They pick Jim McMahon. And then the following year in 1983, Vince in the middle of season just makes the decision, you know, I'm done with this. I'm not getting a chance. They're never going to play me. And so he goes to play for the Chicago Blitz. And when he signs his contract, he's one of the highest paid quarterbacks in all of football, regardless of where they're at. Because the Blitz understood the appeal of Vince Evans, that he's fast, he's electrifying, and we need to sell tickets. Vince in Chicago. And they got a new coach, Marv Levy, and they're going to try all of his experience with him. It doesn't work out. The next year, he's with the Denver Gold. Does pretty well, but then the following year, USFL is done. Doug is in a similar situation. Doug leaves in before the 1983 season, but he leaves because the owner of his team at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, is, as Doug says it a number of times in real time and in his autobiography, he's a racist. And he wouldn't pay Doug his worth. Doug, by the time he's a free agent negotiating his contract, he's about the 54th highest paid quarterback in the league. Yet he's one of the top players in the league. And the ownership wouldn't budge off a contract. Doug wanted $600,000. They only wanted to give him $400,000. This is at a time when, you know, some of the guys are starting to sign million-dollar contracts. And he says, I'm done. And the Oklahoma team in the USFL gives him a contract, pays him what he wants, pays him what he's worth. And he goes over there, plays in Oklahoma 1 year. That franchise eventually moves to Arizona. He plays there. And then, like with Vince, he's out of football because the USFL is done.
Now, there were some disparaging remarks made by some notable sports analysts. Talk to us about that brought this particular issue to the forefront again.
Are we talking about the one that used
Camp
to that used to be on? Oh, Camp Hannis. I thought we were talking about Skip Bayless. Okay, Camp Hannis.
Oh, so, well, we're not going to talk about Skip.
We're
not
going to do that. So, our Camp Hannis. So it's 1987.
Right.
It's Jackie Robinson Day, and he's on the news, mainstream news, and they're talking about black leadership, and all of a sudden he goes off on some racist rant, right? And luckily, the white folks at the station at that time, there's a sports writer, there's a newscaster kind of call him out on his stuff. But he goes on a rant about, you know, lack of intelligence, leadership skills, but also something about swimming, how black people can't swim. And it really raises a dialogue in America about black leadership. And I think the key about this book is to understand, even if you're not a football fan, this book is really about, you know, the promise of civil rights, right? That merit's going to matter and that black people can climb this ladder in business world. And so a lot of folks look to the quarterback as the main leader. They're the most popular folks. I would say if we're in 1987, you know, obviously Jesse Jackson is gearing up for a run. He has some popularity. But it's those quarterbacks like Randall, Warren Moon, and eventually Doug leaning into the Super Bowl that are what really get people, right? What people are really watching. And the fact that there's no black leadership in really those major sports of baseball and football really speaks to what Al Capanis, who was at that time working for the Los Angeles Dodgers, is saying. And it really creates this atmosphere for folks to have a dialogue about race. But the NFL kind of just pushes it aside. They're like, we're not dealing with this. Eventually, they'll hire a black coach in Art Shell. You know, eventually Doug will get his chance with that. I think that's probably one of the most important moments in all of sports, right, where he stuck his foot in his mouth, started talking about racism, got called out for it, but also opens up this dialogue.
Dr. Lewis Moore, professor of history at Grand Valley State University, historian, co-host of the Black Athlete Podcast, and author of The Great Black Hope, Doug Williams, Vince Evans, and the Making of the Black Quarterback. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future in Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows on the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr.
Help protect your family from flu this season by taking three easy steps. First, get yourself and your family a flu shot. It's quick and can protect you all season. Second, take everyday actions to help prevent the spread of germs, like flu. Cover your mouth. Stay home from work or school if you're sick, and wash your hands often. Third, there are drugs that can treat flu illness. These work best when started early. Learn more at cdc.gov/fightflu.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives. Today, we also face a mental health pandemic that threatens our well-being as we attempt to rebuild our social networks and communities.
The pandemic has reminded us to value family, community, and our human connections. However, it has also left many of us feeling more isolated, confused, and alone, struggling to find meaning amid loss and uncertainty.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges. But many of us do not understand what we are facing or know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you are going through, and we are here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health. If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
The cost of housing has risen sharply in recent years, including for college students. Living in a dorm or renting an off-campus apartment can be the single largest expense a student faces, even more than tuition. Laura Barone-Lopez reports on how students are coping with the high cost of living and how some universities are responding. It's the first part of our fall series, Rethinking College.
Senior Adrian Aguilar is studying civil engineering, but one of the biggest stressors during his time at the University of Texas at Austin has not been academics. It's how much he has to pay in rent.
When you left home to go to college, did you ever expect to have to worry this much about housing?
Not at all. I didn't think that it was customary for each person to be paying over $1,000 for decent apartments. I just didn't know.
Aguilar was raised in a rural city south of Houston by parents who immigrated from Guatemala. He has scholarships and financial aid to cover tuition and get some help from his parents. But it's never been enough to cover his rent.
I definitely need a job now to afford housing here, which it does eat it into my time, but that's just the reality of the situation.
Last year, Aguilar paid about $1,000 a month for a room in an off-campus apartment that had no natural light in the common areas. But it was walking distance to campus. This year, he's on the southeast side of Austin, paying about $200 less each month. He says it's far less depressing. But now, getting to class is a 20-minute drive, followed by a more than 30-minute walk.
And I'm lucky because the engineering center is the closest to the parking lots, so I can't imagine somebody who has classes more south of campus.
For more than a decade, Austin has been one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. Though down from pandemic-level highs, average rents are still 20% higher than they were 5 years ago.
Back when I was in school, that one building, the Castilian, was the only one still here. And you could actually see all the hills.
Jay Hartzell is the president of the University of Texas at Austin. And he acknowledges that housing is a major concern for students.
We are, in some ways, a huge beneficiary of the boom of Austin. I think we're part of that. But that growth has a cost, and we've seen prices go up.
At the University of Texas, the cost of tuition has actually fallen 16% over the last 5 years. But like many four-year public universities across